Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Botanic Gardens takes a huge step forward as the first piece of their 25-year master plan opens to the public this weekend. The Tandy Floral Terraces opens with over 8,000 permanent plants and 7,000 seasonal plantings set on a little over 3 acres of the garden's 170-acre footprint. The grand opening takes place this Saturday at noon and will feature architecture that reflects Tulsa's Art Deco heritage and terraces that will host perennials, roses, Mediterranean and Southwest plantings, and water features. Joining us today is the Botanic Garden CEO and President, Todd Lazang. Prior to joining the Tulsa Botanic Gardens, Lazang has worked at gardens in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. He's a well-known leader in the field of public horticulture, and his visits to over 350 public gardens worldwide has helped him in showcasing Tulsa's and Oklahoma's varied landscapes within the gardens, as well as the designs of the gardens themselves. Again, the opening activities take place this weekend at the Tulsa Botanic Garden, northwest of Tulsa, and Todd Lazang is my guest today. Todd Lazang, welcome to Studio Tulsa again, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's a pleasure to be back.
It's a big weekend for the Tulsa Botanic Garden. This has taken a lot of work, a lot of time from a lot of people who have been putting in big efforts to get the Botanic Garden off the ground. And when you were brought in, you said, you know, this is going to be a long project for the Tulsa Botanic Garden. And it is. You just can't create a garden in a year or two. It takes years and years, decades, really, to create a garden.
It really does. I mean, for all the work that I'm doing, I'm really never going to see it mature, right? I mean, it's going to be after me, you know, the next generations to enjoy it. But we're laying the groundwork. We've got a wonderful board of directors who just is so passionate about this project. I've got a very talented staff working with me, designers that get excited about the littlest of details. You know, we're working very hard to make sure that we capture the present while also looking to the long term.
And really, the opening this weekend of the Tandy Floral Terrace marks sort of a watershed moment for the garden, because now, from being pretty much a naturalist area, you now have your first major formal gardens in the area. And all of a sudden, it is now an attraction.
Absolutely, Rich. This could be a day one in some way type of aspect for us. You know, this is a major garden, not just for us. This is a major garden to open for any public garden in the United States when you start to talk about a $3 million plus investment. And to look at it as our grand flower garden, you just don't see those things happening as much anymore, and we're excited to be able to celebrate plants in such a bombastic, if you will, way.
So tell us a little bit, for those who have not been out to the site, tell us a little bit about the floral terraces, because it is the centerpiece, really. It's going to be the centerpiece of the garden once it is matured and that 25-year master plan is completed, right?
It is. It's horticulture central, right? I mean, it's not going to change. I mean, not to say that the other gardens won't be beautiful, but this is the garden where we just come out and strut our stuff with the flowers. So we have some topography out there. We have about 30 feet of elevation change when you go from the lake to the top of the floral terraces. And so logically, we chose to terrace the site. Time-honored practice, right? Out in Osage County, we have tons of rocks, and ended up that we had enough rocks to build 600 feet of walls, 4.5 feet high, without even having to go beyond the 3.5 acre footprint.
Wow, that's really amazing.
Yeah, and they're beautiful sandstone. And what we also did on top of that is we themed each terrace differently. So the one closest to the lake obviously has a different feel than the one at the top. And so we've got the lawn terrace with two side areas that we call the tutor alleys, which I can explain later. And we have the rose terrace above, which is not like the rose garden here in Tulsa. We were very deliberate in not trying to copy that. We've interplanted other plants with it to give it a different flavor. Then on top of that, we have the perennial terrace, which focuses on herbaceous perennials planted in a certain color scheme, originally kind of created by Miss Gertrude Jekyll, a famous British garden designer. And then the final terrace is called the Mediterranean Terrace, and it's kind of our area where we can celebrate plants that enjoy drier environments, you know, whether they're from the Mediterranean proper or western Oklahoma, Arizona, Texas, maybe a few cold, hardy things from Mexico. So it's really different, you know, and as you stroll up through the garden, you get a difference in change of the actual plants we're using, and then there's some connectivity with a central band of what we would call change-outs, so seasonal displays. bulbs in the spring, summer tropicals that go into the fall, and then winter annuals. And that connects the whole garden top to bottom and also bisects each of these terraces.
Of course, you also have a water feature from the top, this 30 feet of elevation that's going to flow down to the lake, right?
Yes. When I moved here in 2011, we turned pretty hot that summer, you'll remember, right? So I told the designers, I said, I want water everywhere, right? 7 acres for the lake isn't enough. So we chose to connect this garden top to bottom with a recirculating formal water feature, which is beautiful. And there's actually two secondary ones on the north and south periphery, which go about halfway up. And they borrow elements from Persian and Italian classical gardens, and I think people will be able to enjoy that.
Now, having the flowing water, does that make a big difference, say, in the heat of a more typical Oklahoma July and early August than we've had the last couple of years, where you're looking at 100-degree temperatures? Does that flowing water make a big difference as far as the temperature where the plant is?
On a very small scale, it will for the plants. You know, we group some plants that like, you know, a little bit of splash, I guess you could say, a little extra moisture in the soil closest to those features. But the main effect is really, for us, a little bit of a psychological effect of feeling like you're not quite in the Sahara, you know, when we're in some of our 100-degree doldrums.
Well, now this garden will feature about 15,000 plants all told, I think, 8,000 permanent plants, and then about another 7,000 seasonal, a little change out. Are there the typical varieties that you'll see grown here in Oklahoma in a backyard garden, or will they be something special beyond that, or a mixture of the two?
To some extent, there's a mixture, but we've really gone out of our way to have this not be just every man's garden. Yes, there's crepe myrtles, and yes, there's bearded irises, but we put a twist on all of those. Like, all of our bearded irises are what are called rebloomers. They actually bloom in the fall and in the spring. And in the crepe myrtles, we tried to select some of the newer ones out there so that you don't just come and see what you're used to seeing. But sprinkled in amidst that pretty liberally are a healthy dose of plants that you're probably going to see for the first time. And a lot of cool Oklahoma natives on the one hand, a lot of just cutting-edge new horticulture stuff, and of course, there's always risk that comes with that. We might kill them, right? But a good friend of mine says, I don't believe a plant is cold hardy until I've killed it three times, you know? So we'll just, we've got to try. I mean, we're a botanic garden.
Well, right, and Tulsa already has a sort of demonstration garden like the Linnaeus Garden, and you don't want to duplicate what they're doing, right?
Yes, what Barry and them have created at the Linnaeus Garden is extraordinary, and we are not trying to duplicate that. This is our flower garden. So although I have said that, you know, we're testing some plants, we're not testing everything there. I can't afford for the bones of this garden to fail in the first winter or summer, right?
Right.
But we've peppered in a lot of good things that I think will delight people. And, you know, I've got my plant geek, you know, cohorts around the country. They're going to come here. They're going to expect to see a little bit of unusual things that I've thrown in there, right? So
right.
I got to keep up with the others.
Yeah. Does the varied climate create additional challenges or additional advantages? Because the fact that we do have very, very hot summers, we can be very humid some summers, we can be very dry others, we can be warm in the winter, and we can be really cold in the winter.
Tulsa's at a very interesting point in the U.S. It's a crossroads both north and south and east-west when it comes to, I think, which plants can grow there. So we're not that cold that we can't grow some of the southern plants, but we're cold enough to grow the northern plants because we have enough winter chilling. And then on the east-west side of things, we can get away with a little bit of both. You know, one person once told me, you'll grow a lot of stuff there, Todd, but none of it will look as good as you could see elsewhere. And maybe there's some truth to that. But on the other hand, I mean, it allows us to experiment. Like, we've got a few things we're going to try to pull out of Colorado and see if they're going to do. Now, they're not the highest elevation plants. I know better than
no
that.
No aspens.
Right. No, we're not going to do aspens. But, you know, although there's maybe one we might try in the children's garden. But,
you know, in Monticello in Virginia, they keep trying to grow an aspen because Lewis and Clark brought them back an aspen to the Monticello, and they just keep replanting it and planting, and it dies and it dies and it dies. Yeah.
Yes, and we'll experiment with things. But, I mean, there's a couple of southeastern plants we're trying here. And then there's, like I said, some plants from New Mexico or Colorado that we're going to try here also.
So you'll see sort of like that high plains garden in that Mediterranean area where you'll see some agaves and things like that, as well as some of the things you would see, say, on the Greek coast or something like that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a perfect analogy. Actually, I had, over the 4th of July, took a little mini vacation with my wife under the auspices of picking up a plant for the garden, and we went to a nursery in Grand Junction, Colorado, just to get one particular plant. It was a cactus in this case that we really needed for the Mediterranean terrace. But it's actually an Oklahoma native that I couldn't find anyone growing in Oklahoma.
Really?
Yeah.
And how would it be an Oklahoma native if nobody grows it around here?
Well, if the tree falls in the forest.
Well, now you earlier mentioned some of the aspects of this Tandy Floral Terrace, which opens this weekend, Saturday at noon, at the Tulsa Botanic Garden. My guest today, Todd Lazang, the president and CEO. We've mentioned the Cascades, this water feature that's going to go down right through the middle. Yes. And there's a sort of serpentine trail that goes up the side of the hillside. And as you walk up it, you're going through these various terraces with different plantings in each one of the terraces. And you mentioned the allee, which is a covered area, I assume, where you're going to have some vine-like plants. Describe this. What is it again?
Sure. Well, allee is a French word. Oh, it just means an avenue. Right. And to tour is the term we've used. It's really just an architectural term that refers to a vine support structure. And they kind of look like little oil derricks. So you can buy these in classic garden ornament places, you know. So we have these beautiful standard crepe myrtles or single trunk crepe myrtles, 8 of them, and then we have these 8 tutours set in them with the secondary water features running right through. There's 2 of these. It creates a very intimate little spot with some shade, which is really nice, and they're set on either side of the main lawn at the bottom.
You know, and that's one of the things I think when you're designing this garden, you have to think of all the different conditions you're likely to see in an Oklahoma summer or spring and fall. In the last couple of years, we haven't had the heat we're used to, so I assume there's lots of shade. There will be lots of shade in this area as the area matures, right?
Yes, we have shaded areas. Now, flowers generally like sun, so we have some areas where we've just used upright growing trees to give the illusion of shade, psychology at work again, and other areas where we have small-sized trees that we're just going to have to thin the canopy so they don't cast too dense of a shade over time or else the flowers underneath them will decline.
Yeah. Now, how important was the siding for this? Because I think the way you've sided this sort of gives you, when you're at the top of the terraces, you're looking right back at downtown Tulsa, right? It's a great view.
Yeah, it's a wonderful view. I've walked all around that lake, and we're on the west side of our 7-acre lake, and, you know, at the top you can see that view. We knew we would do something on this side of the lake. It was just a matter, was it going to be conservatories or this garden or whatever? It just made sense that the flower garden should be, you know, protected from the western sun a little bit by having the sunset behind it and then, you know, catch the morning sun. It's just really nice. The conservatories, on the other hand, should catch the afternoon sun because you'll get that heat gain for nighttime warmth, right, during the winters. But, when you get to the top, you can see all of the main buildings from downtown. They're peeking up over the hill, and it's really beautiful.
Now, how long will it take for these gardens to mature? As you mentioned, said, you know, this 25-year master plan will not be mature until well after you and I are both gone.
Right.
But how long will it take for this garden itself to look like it's been there forever?
Well, I think there's a short-term answer in the sense that the perennials and, you know, maybe the small shrubs, a couple of years, they'll look really nice. Mm-hmm. We'll have to start pruning them back, if you will, after that. But, yeah, the trees and the magnolia hedges that act as our windbreaks, these are a decade-long investment, you know, to really get them to start doing their stuff. Then after that, we kind of go into a stasis mode where we just want to keep them in that shape, you know, as long as we can, right? You know, what is this garden going to look like in 20 years? It's going to be completely different than now, and the people tending it then will have different challenges than we have now. But it'll always be really floriferous and diverse and beautiful. And, we may have to decide that this or that tree maybe doesn't fit long-term, that fits right now, but that's the challenge of a garden.
Yeah. Now, you're opening this at the end of the season, really. Will people this weekend get a sense of what this thing's going to look like next spring? Because next spring, you're going to have thousands of flowering bulbs. You're going to have this wonderful spring bloom. But will people get a sense of what it's going to look like this weekend?
Yeah, I think so. They're going to get a sense of seeing a garden in early October. Obviously, they won't see tulip flowers, but we'll be planting those in November. We're planning on planting 100,000 bulbs, so it's going to be a major undertaking. But, you know, the tropical seasonal plants that we put in the last 5-6 weeks, they're looking pretty good. Not as good as if we could have gotten them in the ground in May, but in May it was a mud pit, you know. So they're going to get a really good sense.
If people are out coming out this weekend, first of all, they're going to see this garden, but they're also going to see another garden that's in development, which will open actually next spring, and that is your children's discovery garden. How's that coming along?
That garden's coming along wonderfully. It's a completely different flavor than the Tandy Floral Terraces. There's one main feature we've been constructing for the last 2 months, 3 months, and that is our spring giant, which looks like a giant carved head carved out of concrete, you know, that's kind of emerging from the back end of the garden. And he's going to be the source of our stream, and he's beautiful. You can walk inside the head, and he's got all these stalactites, and he has an oculus, and, you know, the teeth are already in place. So
wow.
It's looking really cool.
And good. And how large would that garden be? About 2 to 3 acres?
Yeah, or? I think the footprint is 2.5 acres, so it's mm-hmm. slightly smaller than the floral terraces, but, you know, it's a more contained garden because you don't want the kids to be able to go just anywhere, right? You don't want to lose them, so you kind of have a little jail-like concept where you surround it by short fences that maybe you hide in a hedge, and you only have a limited number of entrances or exits, and 2.5 acres is still a lot of garden.
Well, that's going to look great in this next spring. And what's the target date for that?
We are basically shooting for May 1st, so we will announce a formal date soon, but we're on schedule.
Yeah. Well, the completion of the Tandy Floral Terraces and the opening this weekend is the first major component of this 25-year master plan, and also the first project of the first phase, which
yes.
is about $17 million, I think.
Yes.
And so what's next on the horizon? And how long is that horizon for that first phase?
The first phase is a 3-year phase, so it's a concentrated bit of time. It's not a hugely long time. Children's Garden will be next. After that, we've just, as of July, had just recently finished raising money through a challenge grant from the Mabee Foundation for a multi-purpose building that we're calling the Round Barn. I had a phone call from my architect this morning on the way in, and so we're getting ready to design that and groundbreak in a number of months.
So that round barn, is that sort of based on the famous Acadia round barn? I guess a lot of the features are based on this area, so you have Art Deco features for this Tandy Floral, the terraces, right?
Yeah, I believe very much in connecting a place to its place, if you will. And so when I moved here 4.5 years ago, I discovered all these wonderful aspects of Oklahoma and of Tulsa that I didn't know anything about. Therefore, the Art Deco, I said, you really got to put that in one of the gardens, and we put it into the formal garden. And then I saw that round barn. I was like, oh my gosh, that is so cool. So we're using it as an inspiration point for this multi-purpose building. It's exciting. And then after we finish that, we have two more gardens to build, the Lotus Pool and the All Seasons Garden, which we're working to start the detailed design on this fall.
So, when do you hope to break ground on those? Would it be a year or so, maybe?
Yeah, it's a little nebulous at this point.
Got to raise money.
We got to raise money. We've raised 13 out of 17 million, so we still have $4.5 million to go. But by next spring, we're going to have a good grasp on when we're groundbreaking. I think it'll be at some point next year, but I don't know exactly when yet.
And, of course, the part of the Botanic Garden, which I think is a brilliant move on the part of the garden, is that you, out of your 160 or 70 acres, a little over 100 of it is going to be left natural
yeah.
in this cross timbers. For people who are going to hike the nature trails into the cross timbers, there's good documentation of what they're seeing and what they're experiencing when they're walking through these very dense blackjack oak forests.
Right. We have an initial amount of interpretation. I'd mm-hmm. like to see that improved into the future. We focused so much effort in the last 2 years on these gardens around the lake. But the really cool sequence, Rich, is that what will happen is you'll walk into the visitor center, and then in order to access the nature trail now, you'll literally have to walk through the floral terraces. And then you'll go into nature. And so the sequence will be immersion in gardens of the world, plants of the world. In the future, you'll walk actually through our native plant garden as the intermediary step before you walk into the natural world. So it'll be most developed to developed only with natives to nature. And I think that's a nice telltale story of our duality as an institution. And not a lot of other gardens can say that they have you know, this type of ability to showcase both ends of the spectra.
Yeah. Now, I would assume a rock garden is down the road at some point, and you were talking about all the rocks you found in the soil once you began getting these terraces. Will it be sort of this Osage County rocky rock garden down the road, or given your talk about how you want to showcase all the diverse ecosystems, will it be something like the Wichita Mountains in southwest Oklahoma, or you haven't got to that point yet?
I've been thinking about that lately. It's funny you should ask. I want to do a really good rock garden. It did not show up on the master plan. It's a, one of those obvious duh moments, you know, but we're going to do it. In the native plant garden, we're going to do the whole state, not just northeastern Oklahoma. And I'm a big fan of geology. I almost went into geology as my first passion. But, so using the strata and the rocks of the different parts of the state is really important to us. Whether that manifests in the rock garden or the native plant garden, or both, we don't know yet, but we're going to definitely use some rocks. They're so cool.
Now, that first phase of the master plan, in addition to the two more gardens that'll come down the road, you're also looking at important infrastructure that's also a part of that. You know, you have to have a greenhouse. You have a big greenhouse to be able to support the garden. What are some of the other things that are involved with this first phase?
Sure. Well, we had to finish all those utilities, so you and I have talked a few times about that. I'm glad I don't have to talk about bringing the mains in anymore, but that has been done. It was expensive. We've also fenced the entire 170 acres in with a deer fence. White-tailed deer is the only animal we kind of just want to say, you know, go.
Thanks, you're nice, but not here.
Yeah. We're your salad buffet. We really don't want you to eat our plants. We've had to do that. We also have to operate the garden for the 3 years that we're in a campaign, and you don't want to be in the business of competing against yourself, right? Mm-hmm. We also are starting our real endowment. We have a commitment for $2.5 million towards an endowment in this campaign, which is significant, and everyone knows why that's important. You know, you can't ever assume that someone's just going to give you money only to sustain you. You have to build it into everything you do. So
that $2.5 million will be used for the operations of everything you're building.
Right.
Basically, it's building in the maintenance along with the garden.
Yeah, and you know, we didn't per se endow each actual garden with enough money to pay for it, but this is our start, and $2.5 million is a really good number. So, you know, operating, infrastructure, endowment. And, there was just things like putting our offices on the site. A year ago, I was still in Harweldon Mansion, right? Hard to believe, right? Yeah. So now we have an office building for staff and another office building for horticulture staff. We've built a tractor shed so we could put our tractor inside and things like that. And we've had to purchase some utility vehicles like the little gators or other carts for our staff to get around. And all that takes money, but I think we've just had a really well-thought-out plan that the board has championed. Our donors have never asked us any questions of why are you spending money to do this or that. And that's just a testament to Tulsa and how sophisticated the philanthropic community is here, you know, in Tulsa.
Yeah, well, I know people will be looking to see the results of this first garden, but people who love botanic gardens are thinking about this garden 5-10 years ago, when it will really be this oasis, and it'll be just beyond, you know, downtown a little bit, and it's a place where you can just really, it'll be, you know, that's the beautiful thing about these great botanic gardens. You can be in a botanic garden in the middle of the city, and all of a sudden you feel like you're a million miles away from the city, and especially with your location, I'm sure it's going to be that way, and it probably already is now.
Thank you. I was out there two nights ago, and we were testing the night lighting in the terraces, which was one of those wonderful moments, but also just kind of settling down and saying, gosh, it's so wonderfully quiet out here. You can see a little bit of the glow of the city, but not too much, and thinking, we're only 8 miles from downtown. I mean, there's not many other cities you could say that and be in almost solitude, you know, and I was putting some pictures on Facebook for my own friends. I've got all my friends all around the country just now, like, Todd, this is incredible, you know. And these are people that work at botanic gardens, right? Or in nurseries.
Well, there's not often a chance to start from scratch.
Right. And this is, we're really doing this. We didn't just get out the railroad ties and do square foot gardening like you used to see on the Victory Garden program, right? This is a real garden with real architectural elements, and everything is designed. And there's a lot of custom, if not almost everything is custom here. We brought plants in from 30 states, you know, including a lot from Oklahoma. And, You know, these types of efforts don't just happen every day, and so there's a real buzz right now on the national scene in horticulture about what we're doing in Tulsa.
All right. Well, you can see the results this weekend when the Tandy Floral Terraces open at the Tulsa Botanic Gardens. It opens Saturday at noon. Todd Lezang, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for having me.
Todd Lezang is the president and CEO of the Tulsa Botanic Gardens, which will be opening the first piece of their 25-year master plan this weekend. The Tandy Floral Terraces opens at noon at the Botanic Garden. For more information about the gardens, as well as directions to the gardens, if you've never been there, the website is tulsabotanic.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Dr. John Schumann.
In the roaring 1990s, I completed both 4 years of medical school and 3 years of residency. Day after day, I read accounts of my contemporaries starting or joining internet startups to great fanfare and loads of stock options. There were many times I thought to myself, why should I continue on this slog? I fantasized about pitching my idea for an internet company that would wow investors by providing not only crackers, but slices of cheese varietals on those crackers for people logging into the website and entering a credit card number. Stock options, glowing media coverage, Super Bowl commercials. In a scene reminiscent of those go-go 90s, Chrissy Farr of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco reports that medical students are abandoning the traditional practice of medicine to join internet companies in the hopes of creating the killer healthcare app. Here's the data. Bay Area medical students from Stanford and the University of California, San Francisco have among the very lowest rates of pursuing residency programs after med school graduation compared to the rest of the country. Stanford ranked 117th among 123 U.S. medical schools, as just 65% of its graduating students went on to residency. That was in 2011, according to Doximity, a physician network that generates data for the U.S. News & World Report Best Hospital Rankings. UCSF is 98th on the list. Only 79% of its graduating students went on to residency. It's pretty easy to poo-poo this. These med school graduates, for all their smarts, haven't had enough training, actually being in the hot seat, to know what practicing medicine in the current climate is even like. Maybe that's the point. They're not encumbered by notions of things being the way they are. I envy their opportunity. Proximity is important, even in a digital economy. But if their companies don't pan out, I do wonder if they'll be able to get back into medicine. Residency is the orthodox pathway, and if a young physician leaves the straight and narrow path, medicine is a challenging profession to re-enter. I also wonder what's going on at those other medical schools near the bottom of the list. Namely, why so many graduates aren't choosing residencies. Is it for the same entrepreneurial reasons or due to other causes?
Dr. John Schumann is the president of OU Tulsa, the host of Our Medical Matters, a limited series, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.